question. We've moved over a number of topics. I just wanted to go back to that question of allocation, and again, we're all finding our eyes on ourselves to a greater or less extent with the new Natural and Built Environments Act, but you'd be broadly familiar with the fact that we've now got some provisions in there, as things currently stand, that do look at some direction coming in the National Planning Framework in relation to allocation, and then also an obligation for allocation plans to be developed as part of these new natural and built environment plans. You understand those are all a bit more explicit than they were in the Resource Management Act.
Yes, I have very little. I haven't read the NBEA, but yes, I understand that.
Come back to the question of data, and I think you may have acknowledged just an answer to a question from my friend Mr. Majuri, but it's obviously really important if there's going to be any substantive development of land, whether it's underpinning ancestral land or otherwise, if there's going to be any substantive development, then we actually need to create some headroom, because at the moment, the current levels are all being operated to the margins. That's a fair observation?
Yes, I think so.
And so if we're looking at, and we'll go back a few years and put on your consents officer hat, if you're looking at an application for a land use change that relates to Tangatawhenua ancestral land,
yes,
then there's probably a range of, and probably whether it's non-compliant or even whether it's a discretionary activity rule, there's a series of bits of information that are going to be what I would say essential to being able to positively consider that consent, and that would include site-specific information around the size of the site. That's important.
Yes.
The specific activities that are proposed post the land use change is critical. The extent to which any takes or discharges associated with that activity might impact upon overall attribute states within the relevant subcatchment is important.
Yes.
But equally, if we're talking about this need or appreciation that there needs to be headroom within the continual moving target, information about what the other activities, existing activities in the subcatchment are, and about the nature and extent to which any headroom has been created because of an improvement in states, would also be extraordinarily helpful. In fact, might be a critical factor for getting it across the line.
Could be. I don't actually see that headroom right now, or headroom before an application is considered, is necessary to allow some development or some land that increases contaminants in some way. I see this whole process, rightly or wrongly, kind of like this. Non-complying activity rule is a contrary to the provisions. And if you don't mind, if I have a little
talk
about
this,
because it is
mean
a similar kind of rural area that you're talking about. I don't see any PC1 provisions that say you shall not grant a consent application for a land use change activity that has some increase or potential to increase contaminants. I also see objective 1 and 2. I kind of compare it to how I drive home. It's kind of, I don't take a helicopter, I don't go straight there. There's lots of zigzags along the way. And I think that's still okay in terms of the wording of objective 1 and 2. So, yes, it is about restoring and protecting, or restored over time and protected. So it is about over time, with the result that eventually the water becomes safe because the swimmer will take food from That's where we want to get to, yes. It doesn't tell me that you can't grant an application that has some degree of increase along the way, particularly for Tamawhiri land where you have its own objective and you have a policy that's clearly anticipating some ability to develop Tamawhiri land. So, you know, yes, they're in conflict. I wouldn't read them as so forensically to say that you couldn't grant the consent for some increase. And there are two policies, I think, that kind of are pretty restrictive in this respect, and that's policy 2E. So it says subject to policy 18. So again, it's referring to Tangawhiri land, subject to policy 18, not granting land use consent changes, etc., etc., and policy 5, which is fairly restrictive in terms of offsetting and compensation. But beyond that, if I was back in the day of consent officer again, and I had an application, I may be wrong legally, but I would look at all those factors that you're talking about. I'd look at, so what are the quantum changes in land use? Where are they? What subcatchments? What's the state of that subcatchment in terms of where, in terms of in relation to the targets we're trying to achieve? What are the kind of mitigating features in terms of the land use, in terms of mitigating potential adverse effects? Are there offsets and compensation presented as or proposed? What kind of impact might they have? And then, you know, in terms of sort of overall and the range of objectives, the range of policies, I would make a call or make a recommendation. I think I can do that in a non-complying activity rule that could allow, in different situations, some development, even with some increase in contaminants, particularly if those increases might be of one contaminant but reduces somewhere else. There are so many factors to take into account, but I don't think the answer is no, we can't allow any development of Tangawhiri land under this non-compliant rule. So that's how I kind of think about this rule and how it might work for in reality.
Yeah, and that's challenging, isn't it? Because yeah, saying it's technically feasible and what the reality is often two different things.
I accept that. It's just the way I see this.
Yes, no, appreciate that. It's not an impossibility, is your point. You did make a comment the other day. I mean, I don't think that you didn't like the term hold the line. But I think the words you said last week were, we may not get that far ahead, but we won't go backwards, I think was the phrase you used.
Yes, but it's paraphrasing really what you would have to do in an actual assessment. Mm-hmm.
But I think it's been, if you accept that, you know, one of the challenges we've always had, iwi and hapu, tangata whenua, have always had when trying to participate in a range of land use activities and in a range of endeavours, is there are a whole lot of existing players and they tend to have occupied all the space, and whether that's water takes or discharge capacity,
sure,
etc.
Yeah,
and so putting to one side that headroom isn't essential, as you put it, the creation of headroom and being able to measure and identify that,
yes,
would be of significant benefit. So if we're moving to this 20% target, if we actually are tracking and we're going to move to 22%, then potentially there's, you know, that's 2% ahead, and I'm not saying you just, that's 2% for Tangawhiri ancestral land, but it changes the dynamic of the equation, if I call it an equation, of the balancing of factors that are in your head, if you've got that kind of information. Do you accept that would be helpful?
I think, yes, I mean, the better information we have, then the easier it will be to sort of apply these policies in any particular case.
Can I just one of the things, issues I suppose I'm unsure about in my mind is in your response to Mr. Ferguson, talking about there being the ability to make the change which has been sought by Tangata Whenua. But based on what you've just said, that's your interpretation.
Yes, absolutely.
But if it comes to the decision when someone, well, they make the application and someone else is making the decision without your mindset, then
yes.
It becomes a discretionary matter where you can't be sure of the consistency of application.
No, can't be. But I have had a conversation with our most senior resource officer, a person called Mark Roppersby, which it was because of that conversation that I'm kind of thinking that's how it would work. That's the kind of way he described it to me as well. So, you're right.
That presupposes that you're both there.
Yes.
Yes. Or making the decision, let's say, 10 years' time.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Wouldn't it therefore be better to have a rule which doesn't presuppose that you're there and has a policy on application which is not dependent on the humans that are sitting there?
Ideally, yes, absolutely.
Right, thank you.
One question in relation to the, hopefully it's a simple question, in relation to the planning joint witness statement. If you have it handy, it's in volume 401, tab 7.
Yes, I have a copy.
And just the second page in, 401.0131, the heading at the foot of the page, 0, which is comments on the entire plan.
Yes.
And then there's a comment there, the plan must have a robust accounting framework to provide baseline information to track the cumulative effects of farming and CVP activities and point source discharges within a subcatchment or FMU, establish the allocation status of a subcatchment or FMU, and to assess whether we are on track to achieve the target attribute states for each subcatchment in the main stem. You see that?
Yes.
Your initials don't appear there, and I just wondered why not.
Actually recall why I didn't put my initials to that. I generally agree with the statement. Not sure. I could say that. I generally agree with that statement.
Thank you. The second one was just moving on to page 0152, page 23 of the joint witness statement, 19, implementation method 3.11.3.3, the accounting system and monitoring. Now, I think I know the answer to this, but I thought I would just double check. The following experts agree with the council's rebuttal evidence version, MRDK, BBHEMSD, and the BB asterisk as a reference back to that overarching comment we talked about. I presume that the only reason your initials aren't there is because you've proposed the rebuttal
version.
Right.
Yes.
I thought that was self-explanatory, but I thought I'd just double check for completeness.
Yes.
I just had one final matter, I think. Document, you've got the rules, but if you go back to our fund non-compliant activity rule. Now, there's a reference in there, as you know, to 4.1 hectares.
Yes.
Obviously, this rule was triggered in that regard where the, not in relation to the commercial vegetable reduction, doesn't seem to have a quantity there, does it? A restrictive quantity?
No.
No, so non-complying regardless of how much. But you've got, certainly, for other types of land use change, and generally talking about the type of land use, land will fit into the second leg. a cumulative net total of 4.1 hectares, that's correct?
Yes.
And I think my friend Mr. Majuri said, why is it 4.1 hectares? And I think you said you weren't sure, but that the hearing committee had, you thought it had come from the hearing committee.
Yes, and I assume that it's an attempt to draw a line somewhere between what would be a minor land use change that wouldn't have any significant impact on the outcomes, and so it's a number that was chosen for that reason.
Okay, if I could.
It's slightly over 10 acres, isn't it? And it will reflect the fact that the basic cadastral pattern throughout the region would have been laid down prior to the metric system being adopted in New Zealand.
Yes.
Isn't it?
I think that is why it says 4.1 as opposed to 4.5, but why it says 4.1 as opposed to...
4.1 is about as close as you can get without getting silly to 10 hectares. It's slightly over 10 hectares.
Yeah.
So it's 10 acres, sorry. And that'll go back to the basic block subdivisions of large tracts of someone else's land, Mr. Ferguson, done 100 and something years ago.
Could well be, sir, but I just wanted to explore a slightly different angle to that.
Well, all right. But people are just asking, why is it 4.1? I mean, that's what jumps
I think out. That, and look, I don't disagree with that. That's why 4.1 appears there. The reason is why it appears there and not elsewhere, which I want to explore.
Ah, okay.
Sorry. So if I could take you to the plan change as notified, so volume 101, tab 1, which we've had before.
Yes.
And within tab 1, if I could take you to page 0063, which is the non-compliant activity rule as notified.
Yes.
And you'll see that reference to reply to 1 July 2026, the change exceeds a total of 4.1 hectares, so that 4.1 hectares was in the notification version,
yes.
So it didn't just come out of the hearing committee, you see that?
Yes.
Right. Now, what I wanted to do was also suggest to you that there was another rationality for that figure being the figure used here by taking you can you turn to page 0057 and you'll see this is the permitted activity rule for small and low intensity farming activities as originally notified?
Yes.
And you'll see there in the paragraph 3, 4 and paragraph 5, 6, 7, you'll see the differentiator used there in that permitted activity rule was whether the property was less than or equal to 4.1 hectares or greater than 4.1 hectares.
Yes.
So again, probably consistent with why the 4.1 is used for the reason His Honour identified, which makes perfect sense. But you can see, linked to your comment about the 4.1 as being, well, things below that are probably low intensity. In fact, it was the very same figure that was an important differentiator in the plan as notified. You can see that.
Yes, I didn't say that 4.1 was used because properties below that were probably low intensity. I was saying that those that, in terms of the non-complying activity rule, a change in land use of less than 4.1, the assumption would be that it's not going to have significant impacts on achieving the objectives or targets.
Sorry, thank you for the clarification. And then if we turn over the page to 0058, you'll see there was another permitted activity rule there in relation to other farming activities.
Yes.
The rule regime is a little bit simpler back in this time, but you'll see in the opening paragraph there the use of land for farming activities excluding CVP and associated diffuse discharge, nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment and microbial pathogens onto or into land, circumstances which may result in those contaminants entering water where the property area is greater than 4.1 hectares. So again, that 4.1 is referenced, especially in those rules.
Yes.
And I just wondered, given what we've now got in terms of look at those small and low intensity farming activities, we don't have that 4.1 differentiator in that rule anymore, do we? We don't have a size limitation apart from if it's over 20, it has to be predominantly horses and poultry.
That's right, which sort of has the same effect, I think, particularly for 3.4.1. It's kind of not 4.1, it's now 20 in a sense.
Yeah. And could you see the logic then, if one was grappling whether through either the non-compliant, but even more so if one was to have a discretionary rule around this, that 4.1 kind of looks a little bit inequitable when it's maintained, when it's shifted in other places?
Yes, possibly. I don't think there's any relationship or needs to be any relationship between the 4.1 hectares used in 3.4.9, the non-compliant rule, which is just a marker. There's no conditions around any of this. It's just saying if you're over 4.1, you have land use, this kind of land use change, it might have some significant effects we need to address. So, but that's different to, I think, the use of 20 hectares in rule 3.4.1 with the conditions that go along with that. I think that's.
But presumably, if you did a land use change for 20 hectares of Dunderfin ancestral land,
yes,
and that 20 hectares complied with the current permitted activity rules in relation to low intensity farming,
yes,
then there shouldn't be any issue, should there?
Well, as I think tried to explain last week, the non-complying activity rule authorises a land use change. So if it is 20 hectares and it's a land use change from whatever to whatever in a particular subcatchment, so the assessment is made, is that going to cause, is that increase in contaminants from that land use change going to cause a problem for the targets? Yes or no, pass, fail kind of thing. But the permitted activity rule authorises following land use, that's the way I read this. So yes, you could still have an increase, it's probably unlikely in this case actually, but you could still have an increase in contaminants but meet the permitted activity requirements and therefore your long-term land use and discharge is permitted.
Yes, so and as it currently stands, and this is, say, as it currently stands, it's kind of, somebody put it, death by a thousand cuts, and in order to operate a 20 hectare small low intensity farm on Tuntumian ancestral land that needs a land use change,
yes,
you simply can't do it because you can only ever get a land use change for 4.1 hectares, and therefore the most you can operate is a 4.1 hectare farm, or you'd have to do 5 successive land use applications, and I think that might breach the intent, which is cumulatively 4.1 hectares.
Not clear on what your point is. I think if it's a land use change that could increase contaminants in a substantial way, then it needs to be assessed. And then after that, the ongoing land use.
I'll put it another way. What is the path for converting Tangatevenu ancestral land from its existing land use to a small and low intensity farm of 20 hectares?
It would still be non compliant. If it's over 4.1 hectares. And this is a problem. It may sound silly at that scale, but that rule needs to be able to address any scale above 4.1 hectares. You've got another rule in with up to 20 hectares, I suppose. But right now, it's a rule for anything over 4.1 hectares.
Thank you. I think those are my questions, Sarah. I have asked over the break, though, done some exploring. So if I'm able to just briefly address you on that in terms of the data you were after. I haven't got the entire solution, but I've found some clues. So if I could take your honours, and Mr. Stocco can read along, back to that Section 32 evaluation report at tab 16 of volume 501.
Oh, information in this report.
It's tricky. And the page reference is 1444, which is page 79 of the report. 1444.
Ah,
and you'll see a heading C2.2.11.4.1, Iwi Land. And the middle paragraph talks about existing land use information that was used for modelling.
Yeah.
And there's a whole bunch of description down there about maps published by Māori Land Court, CNI ownership based on a parcel match was used in Schedule 1 of the Act. Verify the parcel match comparison made with information from New Zealand forest managers, but importantly, it was the next paragraph of this database, WRC 2016, document 8412836, and formed the scenario modelling in round 3.
Wow.
The development of MMOL, which I think is a reference to the Māori owned land. Over 10 years, from 2002 to 2012, was tested to provide an indication of the extent of development that might occur, Hudson and wider. Mm. 2016, the assessment informed the scenario modelling in round 3. And then there's reference, if one goes, moves on to page 1451, you'll see a bibliography for part C. And on 1452, about six documents down, is that Hudson Wada 2016 report, Change of Land Use on Māori Owned Land. And then two pages further on 1454, about two thirds of the way down, Waikato Regional Council 2016, Assessing Land Development Potential in MMOL and CNI Land, document 8412836. And I suspect. They're strongly suspect there'll be useful information in those, and I wonder if they could be added to the request with respect if the court or us, I can ask Mr. Belton was made to produce them. But I think that would be useful to them.
Thank you for that detective work. I agree, the headings or the titles at least seem to indicate that we should at least look at them, and the document numbers hopefully mean that they can be
found. I couldn't find those in a quick look on the WRC website.
No, they're possibly not all online.
No.
But presumably, given the requirements of the archive legislation, they should still exist somewhere.
And there was a third document that I did find online. Which is helpful, albeit it is earlier than these. It's a document dated the 17th of November 2015. It's file number 23/10/01, which I don't think is a date, I think it's a file number. It is a report to the collaborative stakeholder group for their information. It's a subject matter as extent of Māori owned land within the Healthy Rivers subcatchments and current land use categories. And it's from Bill Wosley, the CSG independent chair.
Yeah.
And it helpfully includes a series of maps showing Māori land blocks within the subcatchments and related data, and then an analysis of various land use sites within each subcatchment and known Māori owned land blocks. Now, that 2015 report doesn't have the CNI land added into it. I think that possibly appears in 2016. But I think if that report is online and I can circulate,
would be useful. And send a copy to the registrar, but who can also copy it to all parties. And obviously, Mr. Conlon is the fisher, can double check that and they can verify with the council whether or not those are the correct documents. They may in turn be some others, but that looks like it's helpful. It may cut short the process of trying to get some of the numbers that we're looking for.
That's right. And I think having a quick look at the table, I think the 9,000 hectares, I think, was what was modelled, but that was a subset, so I think it is a bigger figure. But
and presumably, if these reports didn't include your client's land, your client, I expect, probably has its own records that should be reasonably accurate.
Yes, and I made inquiries about that too, and we'll identify those and provide them to the court as well.
So I mean, obviously, Mr. Ferguson, as well as knowing that basic data, part of it is also comparative, but again, we expect that the Regional Council will have some idea of appropriate comparison numbers of land within the region or land within these catchments
that
will do some comparative work.
Well, that's right. As I say, the table in this, the last of the three documents, excludes the CNI land, which will obviously increase the amount in the forestry, but usually does appear to break down by sub-catchment.
Yes.
Native forests and Māori land blocks, forestry and Māori land blocks, dairy farms and Māori land blocks, sheep and beef farms. That's useful information.
That is very useful.
So could I just note that I referred to that report in my rebuttal evidence, paragraph 37, and have listed the totals for each of those land uses. My paragraph 37 of rebuttal evidence.
Oh, yes. Yes, thank you. Of course, some of this, in terms of your evidence and the concerns that you've had, include the mapping.
Yes.
So we can see what the distribution may look like, and that will also be quite important given the way that PC1 is meant to operate.
Yes, so we can certainly find the report, please.
Excellent.
Yeah.
All right.
That was all. Thank you, sir.
Oh, well, thank you, Mr. Ferguson. Now, I think that's all on the list. I'm not sure. Is Mr. Pinnell present today?
Yes, I am, sir.
Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you.
Do you have questions for Mr. Kendall? Would you like to come forward then? You're right, mate.
I'm looking for the most light for my poor eyesight. So.
Well, hopefully you've got enough there. Very good.
Thank you very much. I haven't got many papers, but a lot of questions here, so if I'm not relevant, please stop me. The answers, Mr. Trebilcott, I'm not expecting expensive answers, so hopefully we can proceed on that.
Thank you.
Excuse me, I'm suffering from the virus. And people here down the back?
Yeah.
Okay. So my main series of questions around duplication between Plan Change 1 and the new freshwater plan regulations. And I acknowledge that it would have been far to better position if those regulations had come out a long time ago. Really, for purposes of illustration, I'll just concentrate, at least in the first instance, on the Rule 311.4 controlled active digital farming, and with respect to duplication or even inconsistent decision making between the certifier and the consents team. So really this is a query on efficiency grounds Mr. Bulko will be fully aware that farmers run very lean operations and look to council to do the same that farmers would far rather be spending money on doing physical works on improving the environment than money on giving consents and even certification, but certification is beyond your influence or council's influence to control. So I really want to firstly explore the relationship between the certifier and council. So the regulations in Schedule 2 are quite comprehensive. We give Regional Council considerable control over certifiers with respect to ensuring competency, the appointment process, performance review, continuing practice, proficiency, the complaints procedure, and their dismissal. So with respect to competency requirements include an understanding of a broad range of 12 resource management matters that cover off all the rules and regulations, the triple CV process, and issues more generally, the impact of farming and contaminants on freshwater and freshwater ecosystems, and the actions to manage those impacts. I've got that right in there.
So you're reading from the regulations?
Yes.
Yes. Freshwater farm plan regulations.
So given the aforementioned, do you agree that the regulations make the certifier just as much an agent of council as a consents officer or any other external contractor you may use in exercising the role of a consents officer?
I'm not sure how you would define an agent of council. They are not responsible for implementing the rules in our regional plan.
Are they not in that in approving, certifying a farm plan?
Yes.
They need to know the rules and make sure that things like the large discussion we've had on riparian management, that they, the farmers has got actions in the action plan of the farm environment plan to do so?
Yes, I still see that their role is a technical role of do these farm activities. So it's just purely about farm activities meet certain requirements. It's not a regulatory role that the council is required to implement.
Mr. Pennell, we can, and I'm looking at part one of the schedule to the regulations now, and I can see the list of competencies. These are matters that you can make submissions to us about in terms of how much, as I understand the point of this question and possibly some others you have, how much needs to be duplicated in the plan from what's already provided for in the freshwater farm plans regulations. And you can address us on that and you can point to what is in the regulations and you can express your views about what the government is seeking to achieve by making the regulations. You don't need to ask Mr. Trevilka questions about that and see what his opinion is in relation to it, because that it's really about how the law ought to be applied rather than say what the content of the regional plan ought to be, which is really the focus for us today.
Thank you, that's of assistance. I may need to get you to give me further guidance on that, John. That will probably shorten the question somewhat. Can I just have a moment to cast through?
Sure. I mean, if it assists you, Mr. Pennell, something which is in front of us, absolutely front and centre in this hearing about the contents of the plan, is that the government, having left a lot of these things without any regulatory or national policy guidance for a long time, has suddenly produced a whole lot of things. And we are concerned, as you obviously are, that multiple regulation creates problems for everyone. And Mr. Trevilka has said on numerous occasions that duplication in regulation is not a good thing. People should have one clear standard that they know they need to meet, and then they can get on with it. Now, I don't know that anybody is disagreeing with that. The question is, how do we go about it? Because some of these regulations, of course, do say if there are more stringent requirements in a plan, then the plan can have those. But there's still a question for us as to whether or not the additional stringency is required in the circumstances of this region or any particular FMU or any particular subcatchment.
Okay. Right. At the risk of pursuing this matter too far, I'm interested perhaps in the way the additional what additional conditions might be added as a result of a consent officer doing it, and how would they actually be informed to do apply conditions without going through a farm inspection themselves.
Well, I mean, the kinds of conditions that could be imposed are the ones, for example, in Rule 3.4.4 that council reserves control over. So it might be informational conditions over time that need to be reported to council. It depends on the case. It's the point of a consent is to implement the directions in a way that are relevant to that particular problem that deals with this particular situation. So there'll be a range of things that could be. It may require particular protections for a particular lake with particular values, for example, which is beyond what a farm environment plan certifier would be determining. The certifier might say, well, here's a lake and there's some things that you could be doing, and perhaps we'll write some of these into your farm plan. But again, that's different to the regulator's role through a consent, where they may take science advice about a particular risk and how and whether or not it needs to have a particular protection to avoid that risk. So there is a different, in my view, there's still a different role of the regulators through a consent compared to a farm environment plan, certifying farm plan.
Okay, thank you. Right, look, I'll skip those questions, Your Honour, and go to the optionality of Schedule C1. Too. I think last week you would have heard those questions that were raised to your other team. I pointed out that in other regulatory regimes, such as building consents, is often given to the regulated party, often is given options as to whether to take a high-level principle-based approach, such as Schedule D2 does, that offers flexibility but more complex to implement, versus a standards-based approach that is simple to apply but lacks flexibility, Schedule D1 approach. So I'm asking whether the same sort of optionality could be provided for both permitted and consented activities. The advantage I see is one that it would enable the farmer to do more of the preparation of the farm environment plan and therefore keep the farmer more engaged in this process.
So, what was your question?
So, the optionality of Schedule D1 and D2, instead of permitted being required to take the Schedule D1 approach and controlled or consented activities for the D2 approach, whether there could be an option of the choice of either farmer.
I guess, I mean, it's a possibility. That, I mean, the reason why D1 was set up as requirements for permitted activity farm consents, and D2 for requirements for consented activities. The committee were concerned that under a permit activity rule, there can't be too much discretion in terms of whether something meets that, and so therefore the standards approach is the easiest way to go. So it's almost a yes, no, tick the box kind of farm plan. That's how they were thinking of it. But of course, if you have a consent, then you can have a more targeted look at a particular farm, and so it makes more sense to have the flexibility of a D2 type schedule. In a consent, it's likely that most of the D1 type standards would be required anyway, would be my view. The consent allows you to look at those goals and principles and come up with ways of addressing them. But it's not to say that there may be some of the D1 standards are very applicable to that particular farm. I don't see that a farmer having an option in the way that you're talking about, I don't quite see how that's going to work. That would give you the kind of certainty that a rule needs to have as to sort of how it's going to play, what the expectations are in the rule. I'm a bit concerned about that. Kind of see what you're saying. In a way, I kind of think Schedule D1 should be the standards for all farming, no matter whether it's got a consent or not. Except, of course, there are some cases where it just may not be practical to meet some of those standards, so it can be addressed through a consent. So again, I'm just not sure that the option of a farmer having an option of one or the other is a good way in a kind of regulatory policy type sense, in my view.
Okay, well, come back to that point, but you also touched on the point that maybe parts of D1 could be used to satisfy D2.
Could do, yes.
Yeah. Okay, that's useful. Now, come back to the other situation where there needs to be certainty in the approach. I guess what I'm thinking of is that going through a Schedule D1 process, coming to a roadblock somewhere, that it wouldn't be the farmer who was deciding by using the appropriate part of D2, it would be the certifier approving such a use. So it's really the certainty is provided by the exercise of the decision making of the certifier.
Yeah, and again, I think the certifier says, are the activities that are proposed for the farm going to meet those goals and principles? So again, it's a technical farm systems, farm information type decision that they are making.
Right. So I take that as you thinking there's some merit in such an approach.
Merit of what approach?
In having the optionality that I described at the start.
No more so than I think sits in there already, in the sense that a consent can add Schedule D1 type standards.
Okay, topic is stock exclusion, and back to our 18 stock units per paddock business. given that most paddocks on a dry stock farm are not capable of growing sufficient grass to enable set stocking at 18 stock units per hectare, let alone some increased figure that has been bandied around by various parties, what management practice can this condition control? Because doesn't it mean that such paddocks at 18 stock units per hectare, when they're not capable of being farmed at that level on a set stock basis, the result will be overgrazing and increased damage to streams and stream banks.
Yeah, I mean, I still don't read the 18 stock units as requiring set stocking. It's trying to say that if you land over 10 degrees, and like trying to explain again last week, you've got a paddock, there's a stream going through it, it's unprotected, stock has have access to it. Is there an allowable amount of stock in that paddock that's not going to have a significant effect on the stream without any other provisions, without anything else happening, without any other protections? So that's it's a really simple kind of gateway, if you like, into this sort of saying. So you've got a fence land that's under 10 degrees. If you're over 10 degrees and over that stock limit for that paddock, because it's unfenced, it needs to have a maximum number of cattle that can be in there at any time. That's the way I still see that.
Okay.
Because, as I said last week, you could put two cattle in there per hectare. It's probably not going to break down the banks. Probably, you know, even if they're there, it's often, it's probably not going to have a huge effect if you put a couple of hundred cattle in there and they've got easy access to that stream. I think, in my limited understanding of these things, that there is significant potential for stream bank damage in the way that won't meet the kind of outcomes we're trying to see through here.
Well, I think various people are suggesting in the joint witness statement for farm systems did acknowledge that they're the best way to deal with the sorts of things you are thinking about is by way of actions in a farm environment.
Yes, yeah. Yes. So if you've got more than that stock level, again, for that unprotected stream, there is still the additional clause that says if you have a certifier saying that the appropriate actions are put in place anyway, even without a fence, to achieve those three outcomes and the bullet points, then that's fine, because the certifier is saying there are mitigations going to be put in place even without a fence that should have the same outcomes. So that's kind of those three kind of gateways through that stock exclusion provision, if you like.
Okay, if you can try to answer my first question again, please. What protection would this rule give in the situation that people were set stocking and that paddock was incapable of running 18 stock units on that basis? What protection would that give to protect the banks of streams and stream beds, etc.?
Protecting
streams and stream banks.
So are you saying, just because I don't quite understand, are you saying there are paddocks that you couldn't leave 18 stock units in the long term? Is that
absolutely.
Yeah. I'm not saying that's what needs to happen. Just saying that's... if you've got more than so many stock in that paddock, it has potential to impact unprotected streams. So if you've got more than that number, you need to have other mitigations to protect the stream. So that's what it's saying. My view is that I keep on thinking, I might be misunderstanding here, but I keep on thinking this is not requiring set stocking for that paddock, but it does require some kind of stock management, so that, you know, if you are going to run more stock in there at any particular time, it's not saying all the time, but if you are going above that number, and I agree that the 18 stock units is probably the wrong number, but I don't know what the right number is, but if you're going to do that, then you need to take the extra step of a certifier saying you've got these other mitigations in place.
Look, I simply don't see what protection this rule gives. There's such a question I've been trying to address to you. But
yes.
If you've got nothing further to add, we'll move on.
I was reading your evidence, and you mentioned, I just wanted to point out that you mentioned about adding, changing some wording in the Schedule C, and you talked about it should say if it's impracticable defence, then you should do these other things. As I was reading it this morning, I just thought, well, that's actually, I quite like that. Just pointing out. Not saying I agree totally with the words, but the idea that you're saying, I think, is probably a really useful idea.
Thank you. Last thing on shock exclusion. You pointed out last week that this condition only applies to permits that have unprotected strengths.
Yes.
Acknowledge that. Do you appreciate that? And if rotationally grazing at something much, much higher than stock, as 18 stock units per hectare,
yes,
is precluded, that really puts you into a set stock and sort of regime. And that most dry stock farmers don't have a central race so that they can move stock past each other through the race system. Rather, they have to be shuttled from one paddock to the next. And that if there's some stock in a paddock with an unprotected stream, trying to shuttle rotationally grazed cattle through that is a nightmare. So really, this provision places roadblocks into the normal flow of management of rotational grazing.
Yes, I can see that there are going to be practical difficulties of just having a stocking maximum for the steep land, which is why there is the additional provision for other mitigations through a sort of like
that. That is all, but just before I finish, I'd like to acknowledge all your hard work and long hours you've put into this process. and that you have made great endeavours on trying to pull people together, and it must have felt like herding cats to you for a good period of time. Thank you, Your Honour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honour. Mr. Trevilco, if you can cast your mind back to Friday, my learned friend, Mr. Medjitov, asked you some questions about the CVP rules, and in particular, how those deal with crop rotation. And you offered to explain the way in which those rules work, and I wondered if it would be useful for you to take the chance now to provide that explanation. I'm conscious that...
Think back to what I was thinking at the time.
What you were thinking about. The questions related, I recall, to, in particular, the way in which the rules dealt with crop rotation across sub-catchments and why they require a discretionary activity resource consent for crop rotation at any given use scale.
Yes, so just really quickly, what the panel tried to do was set up controlled activity status for so-called existing CVP, discretionary for very limited increase, and still an ability to go to the non-complying rule for anything above those limitations. And of course, we talked last week about the difficulty of determining what is actually existing CVP, and I tried to make a point that the committee tried to find a way of, in a sense, providing a proxy for how much CVP was occurring in each subcatchment at the time of notification, because that's what they were trying to pin down in terms of what is existing. And that needed to be at the subcatchment level because because the targets are set at the subcatchment level. So we needed to know in each subcatchment how much CVP was occurring at the time of notification in order to have a control activity rule that allowed that continuation. And then, of course, there does need to be an allowance for rotation of CVP. And you couldn't, I wouldn't agree to having a control activity rule for rotation that went outside those boundaries for the subcatchment, because that then risks increasing CVP in particular subcatchments and therefore isn't going to support achieving the objectives. So I'm struggling a little bit to understand because I know I had a story I wanted to tell on Friday. I'm not sure I can tell you the same story, I'm sorry, in terms of the way I see all of this working. But anyway, so then we get to expanded CVP. It's very limited. It allows a certain amount within each FMU of expanded CVP, provided that doesn't occur in particular subcatchments where there are particular risks, whether it's a water quality that's already high in nitrogen, for example, or there's particularly sensitive water bodies in that subcatchment. And at that stage, you can have that full discussion about how far rotation should go. So it's not limited to being within each subcatchment. It can be given a wider sort of area, but provided that the assessment shows that wider rotation within the FMU is restricted in some way, so that we're not ending up with a concentration of new CVP in areas where there wasn't any or much less at the time of notification. Now, like I say, I'm not sure if that's and we of course haven't talked about this, so I'm not sure if that's the story I wanted to tell originally, but then of course, as I say, there is an ability to go beyond those limitations and rule through them for non-complying.
Thank you. Thank you, Ron.
Good morning, Mr. Kibilko.
Good morning.
One of the things that's being stressed is the importance of people understanding why it's important for them to buy into PC1. You know, everyone needs to do something to contribute to getting the right outcome.
Yes.
And there are quite a few questions that are coming through, and it's in more than one brief of evidence, things like what's the link between what happens on the land and how it affects the hour. Things like that.
Yes.
How do I know if I make all these changes, it's actually going to make a difference?
Yes.
We've done all this work on fencing, and yet E. coli levels are still going up.
Yes.
Those are the questions that are in people's minds, and somehow we need to try and find a way of addressing those if PC1 is going to be successful. I've got reasonable experience in cases of this nature and land use controls and various things like that. And it was only when I read Dr. Ozay's evidence that I finally came to understand what this case is all about. And it's really that there are specified quantities based on current knowledge that will have to be removed from land use discharges to the environment.
Yes.
And unless you go through all of the information, you're not going to get that. And so people don't understand. And just as a simple example, as an example, in terms of nitrogen, current knowledge is there may be 5,000 or 6,000 tons that have to be reduced over the 80-year period. That's likely to go up when the ecosystem health figures are taken into account.
Yes.
We're looking to remove 20% of that in the first 10 years, which means this, and that reduction will need to come from so much from point discharges. We can't do anything about natural discharges and very little about associated discharges that come from climate change and some from farming. Is it intended to provide some kind of guidance, a document of some kind, to say this is what we're trying to achieve, this is what we've got to do now, in the next plan change we will need to put controls on discharges from individual farms or whatever, and individual or collectively for point source discharges, and we will need to start providing some kind of headroom for TWA and things like that. Now, to me, those are pretty important pieces of information that will help the farming community understand where they will ultimately end up. Not in absolute terms,
yes.
But it'll give them a roadmap.
Yes.
Is there any intention to do that?
I haven't had specific discussions on that and with the implementation team. I expect that they will have some sort of implementation plan that will include a fair amount of information to be provided to farmers through this process. It's pretty normal for what they do. The education component is large. So I can't guarantee it, but I would certainly expect they would provide that kind of information, and it will probably come out in a number of ways. It would probably be through pamphlets and kind of documents that we provide anyway on various things, but I agree there needs to be a specific explanation about PC1 because that's beyond where we've been in the past. So I can't guarantee it, but I certainly expect that they would provide that sort of information. I've had general conversations with a couple of the implementation people about how important it is to work towards getting farmer buy-in to all of this. So I'm pretty sure that they really see that as a problem, and they admit readily that if we can't get farmer buy-in, then it's just not going to work. And so they know that. So we haven't had specific conversations about what they're going to produce, but I'd certainly anticipate that they will.
I just think it needs to go further than PC1. PC1 is the first step.
Yes.
And farmers will want to know, well, what does this lead me into?
Yes.
Where is it going to end? And maybe that won't be known, but I certainly, from my experience, a roadmap helps people understand.
Yes.
And it needs to be in simple, non-technical planning or ecological language. Just simple. We've got to reduce nitrogen by so many tons over this period of time. It's just simple things like that.
Yes.
So I just make that point because it does concern me, because a number of the questions are coming through. They're very fair, very understandable questions.
Mm-hmm.
And unless they're properly answered, I don't think you will necessarily get the level of buy-in that's required.
Yes, I agree.
So I've also been listening carefully to the various discussions of the questioning from Council and Mr. Pennell, for example. And the issue of farm environment plans and duplication is a real big one. And I just wonder whether the amendments you've made go far enough to make it clear what's required. And I wonder what your thoughts would be on some kind of slight adjustment of that to make it more consistent with the structure of the regulations, you know, which start off with risk assessment. So that when a farmer looks at the regulations, he looks at PC1, it would be possible to see immediately the regulations require me to do that, PC1 expects me to address that by doing these kind of things.
Yes.
I know it will be more work now, but it could save an awful lot of confusion and further work later. Do you have a view on that?
I think it's possible. I mean, we've tried to just take out anything that is the realm of the farm, of the freshwater farm plan. So any of the kind of the mechanisms of how you do a farm plan, not the content, but the mechanisms of risk assessment and and certification and all, thing and all of that. We've tried to, well, I've tried to take all of that out, apart from policy four. So policy four has general guidance on farm plans, which does include the need to do a risk assessment and various other things. I think they're all completely consistent with professional farm plan regs. There is content as well. So I've tried to address it that way. Whether it's the right way, that there may be better ways, and I'm certainly happy to think about better words. They are doing different things. Most of the time, the threshold of farm plans are about process, apart from policy 4 and PC1, schedules D1, D2 in particular, are about outcomes. So they're different jobs telling different things about different topics.
I do understand that, and this is not a criticism. You've had a very difficult road to hoe on this.
Yes.
I'm just thinking this is going to be in place for 10 years.
Yes. If we can improve it, absolutely.
And all I'm thinking of, a farmer goes to the regulations, goes to the PC1,
yes.
And then thinks, well, how do I actually link these two things?
Yes.
And I just wonder whether a little bit of extra work, you put the regulations, start with the risk assessment, say how that's, what the requirements of PC1 are in relation to that.
Yes.
Then go on to the outcome. So it's absolutely logical all the way through, and the issue of inconsistency should hopefully go away. I'm not saying you should do this. I'm just asking whether you would see any value in possibly looking at it from that point of view.
Certainly think about it and see if there is something we can do to make that easier. Yes.
Okay, that'll be good. Thank
yes.
Now, you said that you think a Section 293 process is required in relation to the regulations. Is that correct?
Yes, I have said that, yes.
Well, I'm a little bit unsure why, because the regulations are a legal requirement for compliance.
Yes.
You're not actually making any requirements of PC1 more restrictive than what they were in the decisions version.
No.
So why do you need to go through a Section 293 process?
Well, I am suggesting some significant changes to Schedule D1 and D2, particularly taking out all reference to certifying and auditing, or most of the references. So it is a significant change. It may be possible to do it without a 293 here. If there is enough scope within the appeals, I mean, we know there are some general appeals that talk about improving the sort of consistency and clarity and just making it easier to understand the provisions, and maybe those give some scope to sort out the conflicts between the farm plans, the farm ground plans and official farm plans, but we need to look a bit more closely at that probably.
Yeah, you've heard the court's concerns before about Section 293 process.
Yes, absolutely.
You could delay 3-6, we don't know how long.
Yes.
And that has major implications for delaying progress on debt-to-be phenomena.
Yes, absolutely.
So I think that's something that people do need to think about very carefully.
Yes.
Could I just ask one thing? Mm-hmm. It feels like we might take a break for just 1 o'clock.
Right.
Just also in relation to Section 293 and your concern about the changes we're making, a relevant consideration is whether or not the changes could have unforeseen or unlooked for effects on people who may not have otherwise been involved in this process.
Yes.
The impression that we have is that through the stakeholder groups who are here now, there's a pretty full engagement by representatives, at least, of affected persons. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do agree with that. Having said that, I don't know if there are particular individuals out there who might not feel that way.
Sure, all right. So there might need to be a check to guard against that.
Yes.
But, I mean, there are a number of Section 274 parties who have given notice of their interest in this matter, but, and with the exception of Mr. Cannell, and of course it's excellent to have an individual farmer here taking an interest in participating.
Yes.
But most of those other Section 274 parties plainly consider that the council for their representative organisations are able to make sure that the issues are covered.
Yes.
And contest between clearly different sides of the question around the control of these contaminants, don't we?
Yes.
With Fish and Game and the Director General of Conservation plainly looking at the conservation issues and so on, and we have farming industry representatives plainly looking after those people who are going to have to do the hard work.
Yes.
It's time for us to take a break. Now, you are no longer under cross-examination, so you're no longer under exclusion, because the questions which the Commissioner and His Honour and I will be asking you are for clarification and exploring these issues rather than testing your evidence. So you're welcome to have lunch and so on with whoever you like.
Thank you, Dave.
Now, in terms of people being able to get some lunch, I know there's a little bit of an issue about where we are at the moment and travel to places, but if we still aim to return in 2:15, is that likely to be acceptable, manageable? Yes?